So I think we should just get going. People might filter in, and today I was thinking, in the last couple of days in the class, we've had a lot of discussion of where we've offered different answers to different questions, and today there'll be a lot of information. And on the way down here, I thought, well, maybe that is okay, that when we come to Black theology and womanist theology, we're a little bit more silent and listening. Hopefully it'll still be interesting, and I would want to encourage you to raise your hand, ask questions, or toss out comments as we go, or say, or throw out, what is that term? You know, you keep using this term, and I'm not exactly sure what it means, because chances are 95% of us don't know what it means either. So just toss out any kind of questions as we go along. What we've been doing, I'm Dr. Merritt Charleston, and I'm at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. And prior to there, I was at Gustavus Adolphus for 3.5 years, California Lutheran University for 3.5 years, and then spent a semester at St. Olaf, and so I've taught at a number of Lutheran liberal arts colleges, and I've been at PLU here in Washington. This is my 7th or 8th year, something like that, going into my 8th year there. So the week that we're doing here, and there I teach constructive theology, Lutheran theology, and some courses in women's studies. So that's women's studies being feminist and womanist theology. We'll talk today too about the term womanist and why, what the difference is, what the name indicates, a difference in feminist, womanist thought. In the last couple days, what we did is we went through atonement theories, both the meaning of the symbol of the cross, and then we also looked at some of the main questions of why did, we put them up on the back, just so if you wanted to take a look at them, of what we've done if you haven't been here. Why did Jesus die? And you can see we just kept answering things, adding things over the last couple days. We keep adding and adding and adding to that. There's multiple interpretations of that. Did he have to die? When was it determined? From the beginning of creation, from the beginning of the fall, did Jesus choose it during his lifetime? Did he accept it during his lifetime? We went on to, for whom is the death ultimately effective? Meaning, who kind of needs the death to occur? If we think it's needed, who needs it? And we had everything from us, God, the devil, Israelites, all of creation. Also to who killed him. Was it the institutions, the angry mob? Was it kind of, if you keep going back and causal, looking for the cause, is it originally really God who kind of sets this whole death in motion and carries it through and plans it? Is it Jesus who kind of commits suicide in a way? That's not the right word to use exactly, but at least an active role in his own death. Martyrdom. Martyrdom is probably better. Yeah. So we've been doing this. We're moving on today to talk about what I wanted to do was set up Black theology and the Christologies coming out of the 1969-1970s, part of the Black Civil Rights Movement. Move from there into Black or African-American women responding to that and saying how that both echoes their concerns and yet also didn't satisfy some of the needs of Black women, and kind of claiming their own name, distinct from feminist theology, distinct from Black theology as womanist theology, of having concerns of both of these and also some new added concerns. So we'll look at that in Christology and then move on to their images of the cross. Both, I had promised you, and some of you might have read Dolores Williams' article where she critiques the cross as glorifying surrogacy, suffering on behalf of the other, and how because African American women's lives have been filled with forced or voluntary suffering for others, that it's a very damaging symbol for Black women. And we'll also look at Joanne Marie Terrell, who is somebody who thinks there is power in the blood thinks that the cross and the sacrifice have some great power to it. So another black womanist theologian looking at the cross. So that is where we're going today, and we'll look at their arguments in detail. For tomorrow, if you're still in the village and want some reading, I would say I had offered that Dolores Williams was the one who kind of rocked the world with her statement, rocked the theological world with her statement of saying the cross is not helpful as a symbol for black women, and then talking about her argument behind that. And I would say that this book, the article I brought for tomorrow, if you're interested in reading it, looking at tomorrow is feminist, white feminist theology and Lutheran feminist theologians who are all white that we'll be looking at. Today we have, I hope we can get to her, otherwise we'll fit her in somewhere here, but Mujerista, or Latin American Lutheran theologian, Alicia Vargas. So we'll also be covering her work today, tomorrow, depending on time. But the article I have here, I would say, is a powerful explanation of the critique of some feminists, not all, but some feminist theologians, again, of the cross, or of the idea that violence or death or murder can be redemptive. And their word, the title is "For God So Loved the World?" with a question mark. And it's done by Joanne Carlson Brown and Rebecca Parker. Rebecca Parker is one of the authors who co-authored two of the books that are in the bookstore, Proverbs of Ashes and Violence, Redemption, and A Search for What Saves Us, I think is what it's called, and then Saving Paradise, the more recent one with Rita Nakashima Brock. The For God So Loved the World talks about women's experiences of abuse and how the cross and women's experiences of abuse come together to create some very damaging or dangerous messages. And I'd say that this article boils down some of those critiques and concerns into one article rather than having to read their entire books. So it's worth picking up. I think I have 15 copies, and you can grab one, you can share them if we run out. But I know that one of my colleagues and his students, they read this, and it's always in one of their classes on the suffering God is the title of the course. And the class always explodes because it really challenges this notion of suffering being, if suffering can ever be redemptive. And I think in one of the quotes that Rebecca Ann Parker writes in Proverbs of Ashes that we'll look at tomorrow, she says, you know, what if suffering is destructive and it's not redemptive? What if there are other things, you know, that are life-giving? But, you know, they're trying to actually challenge that idea of redemptive suffering at a very primary level and saying that they think that that's very dangerous based on their experience as pastors and theologians. So there's the reading for tomorrow. In looking at today, any kinds of thoughts or questions or comments? I know we ended yesterday. We've gone through our questions, we talked, we were processing things as we were going, but I was wondering if at this point, would you like to pause for a moment and kind of think of verbalize what you've been thinking about in the last couple days, or should we press on ahead into black theology? Any of the thoughts or questions or concerns that have been coming up in the last days looking at this?
I'd like to press ahead.
Yeah?
I think,
ready to go.
Both days. Yeah, you know, so that I,
yeah.
I'm
get
ready
more stuff.
To, I do. I want to hear other thinking.
Yeah. Other people okay with that? We have time for more talking at the end? All right, let's go on. Let me set some things up for you. I'll use some things on the whiteboard, and then we'll put other things up on these to bring back. So that at the end of the week, we won't necessarily have these up, but the next couple days we'll be building this pantheon of authors and perspectives. And we'll surround ourselves with them so you can see them all on the walls around you as we go. So by Friday, we should have, you know, Jurgen Moltmann and Douglas John Hall and these feminist, womanist people up on the wall. So you can see all these different perspectives that are in the chorus right now of conversation. And looking at black Christologies, and Christologies are just images of Christ, images of Jesus, and building those. Black theology, and this might be review for some of you, I'm not sure, but black theology emerges out of primarily the late 1960s. It's pretty exciting that I don't think I'd ever put together the publication dates of the most famous black theologians that came out, the most famous feminist theologians that came out early on, and the most famous liberation theologians from Latin America. And they're all within a 5-year time span. So 1968 to 1974, you see an explosion in the theological world that births these traditions. And all right then, there's just a lot of work going on that's very novel, taking different contexts into view. Black theology comes around this time. And let me give you a couple of their Christologies. I had actually talked to James Cone, who's probably the most known black theologian. His name's international again. And he is working currently on a book looking at the cross in particular. He wrote a lot about Christ and about Jesus and his significance, but not necessarily on the cross. And it was nice to hear a very well-established theologian say, I'm not sure I have enough to say on that at this point. You know, I'm working on it right now, so we'll see some work specifically on the cross, I think, coming out very soon from him. A couple of Albert Cleage wrote a book called The Black Messiah. Can you see?
I can see.
Okay. All right. We'll underline the right thing here for you. In 1969. In it, he argued that Jesus was literally black. He looks at lineage, where Jesus might have come from, the tribes he might have been descended from, and their origins, and says not only was Jesus not white, like in the Scandinavian, you know, in the kind of depictions, the white depictions of Jesus with the light blonde hair and blue eyes, and the very Aryan features, he says not only was he not white, but he wasn't even Middle Eastern. He was black. He looked much more black than we would ever imagine. And what's the value for Jesus being literally black and making that argument is that Jesus is clearly identified with the black community in the civil rights struggle. Some people said, oh, you went beyond historical evidence, right, for this. But it's interesting that this Kelly Brown Douglas, who writes in 1994 as a womanist theologian, goes back to Cleage and says, you know, it's a pretty good argument that Jesus probably was more African at any rate than he was anything else. And what does that do, that image? He encouraged black communities to take down white images of Jesus out of their churches and put up black images of Jesus, and that even that symbol would have a huge influence on the self-esteem and power of those communities in seeking justice, the identification with Christ. So he says he's literally black. He really was from Africa, and all the importance for the black community. Others took different routes in their arguments. J. Deotis Roberts wrote a book called Liberation and Reconciliation. And again, he's right around the same time. A Black Theology is the subtitle. And he takes a different tact and was also critiqued by some of his colleagues for it. He focuses on the incarnation that Jesus is, was the universal Christ, and let me write it up here first. He makes his, the argument, he says, he focuses on the incarnation and the universality of Christ, that God becomes human, not just one kind of human, but to represent all humans. Thus, any human, no matter what race or anything, can also claim Jesus, identify with him in contemporary times, because Jesus continues to come. So he goes on a more universal route for his argument. The thing he's critiqued about for this argument by others in the black theology movement is that the white oppressors, so you're saying like, Jesus, we can claim him and the white oppressors can claim him. And so how is this effective for black liberation? Everybody can, but he found this to be a meeting point between the black and white communities. I'm not sure whether there was, not sure that the rest of the black theological community was ready for that move yet, of saying we're all together in this one conversation. But he was also critiqued for that because it didn't have that specificity that Jesus was on the side of black liberation against white oppression. James Cohn, who I mentioned in 1970, Black Theology of Liberation was his first. He essentially, Jesus is on the side of the oppressed. And he has that black people in the civil rights movement are the oppressed. So Jesus is on the side of the black community. And it was stronger than that even, essentially also saying not only does Jesus side with us, but you white people had really better think about that. Because Jesus is not on your side. It was a very strong, Jesus was black was his most famous article. And I remember reading it in college and wondering like, what? What is he talking about? You know, I'm just like, I have no idea even what you're saying. How could Jesus be black? The meaning was totally lost on me, but I remember struggling with it and going into class and since then. So it was a, and white people are not the oppressed, essentially. Let me put that down.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Based in ignorance, which is, I presume that many white theologians had observed that Jesus was on the side of the oppressed.
Yeah.
Is what's new here that the white man is the oppressor?
Yeah. And I think, actually, I will even build on what you just said, right? What's new here is to essentially say Jesus is not on your side. Jesus is not like you. So what does that mean for your life? And how are you going to change things in the civil rights movement? So, yes, that is what's new here. And I'll even pick up on the fact that later on, in all of these discussions, you definitely have a strong James Cone's idea of God on the, or Jesus and God on the side of the oppressed, and black people here. What's missing in this analysis? Wait, let me back up for a moment and say, even when I went to Namibia 2 years post-apartheid, and had the chance to volunteer in a Lutheran congregation there. And while I was there, I even then was saying, like, you know, well, like, theologically, when you're fighting against the South Africans, the white South Africans, you know, militarily, they would even say, you know, we're guerrillas, you know. We were the guerrillas. And I'm like, I know that. But what I want to know is, like, what's the theological? You're Lutheran. you're Lutheran guerrillas, right? And you're out there with guns fighting the white people. And like, what's your theological basis? And every single one of them said, you've read James Cone, right? And I said, yes, I've read James Cone. James Cone was a huge theological motivator. I can't speak for the South African struggle for against white apartheid, but certainly in Namibia, James Cone's theology was the thing you were reading. If, like I mentioned yesterday, if Jürgen Moltmann was being read in Latin America during their struggles for liberation, James Cone is the one who was all over South Africa and Southern Africa. Later on, and of course, black women and black men were involved in the black civil rights movement. It was only later that black women looked in their own black theological tradition and then this white feminist tradition and said, well, you're kind of arguing in a way for middle class white women's autonomous rights. And we'll read that a little bit. And that's not exactly our issue. Or it's not exactly where we're coming from. And then they were saying, and then somehow we've been fighting alongside you for black liberation for 15 years, but our church is so patriarchal that we're not even, the women who fought for civil rights aren't acknowledged. We're not allowed to preach or speak in the churches. We're relegated to the basement. And they're like, what do you mean? God's on the side of the oppressed. Well, then Jesus is a black woman. And so I think the voice starts coming out 10, 15 years later. We've missed something here, folks. And not only that, they said, well, within the black community, just being black isn't enough. Because some blacks have and some blacks don't have. And there's economic oppression within the black community, and those who have got their goods by working their way up the white or patriarchal system are not necessarily acknowledging that they're oppressing others, even within the black community. So their critique became, even in the black community, we have forms of oppression. One of them is gender, one is socioeconomic, and we need to call all this on the carpet, and these guys didn't do it. They fought for white versus black rights, but it ended up, they said, being black men's rights, primarily. So what's missing here is they said this kind of gender and class analysis, and the other thing that numerous black women theologians have raised is the homophobia. I would say they've almost led the white and black theologians in thinking about homophobia in the sense that they said the black churches certainly aren't, within the black churches, these black women theologians are saying, we oppress gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people. We don't talk about it, and specifically, we're happy to put out a very anti-gay message. And so they called on the carpet, in a sense, their own community for participating in multiple forms of oppression.
I always thought God missed the boat when Mary should have had twins. Jesus and Gisette.
there's that Christmas card. Somebody, what some student sent it to me. I'm sure you see it where it's Mary and Joseph looking in there and it says, it's a girl! On my door for a little while. So it's kind of fun. So Kelly Brown Douglas comes along in looking at just Christologies, and then we'll get down to her actual image of some of the cross images here. Kelly Brown Douglas writes a book called The Black Christ. And it's in 1994, so it's a little while later here. She here critiques, like I was mentioning, the class, gender, social analysis, homophobia of black theology and the black church as a black theologian. And then she moves on to say, but we're not really, we're not with you gal feminists either. And she says, it's kind of a beautiful, I'd forgotten all about it until I was reading this again yesterday. She talks about feminism as, like every other form of white privilege basically being a parasitism off of black women's work. So black women did the work, and then white women were parasites and then took it further, you know, took what they took their value and ran with it. She says in here, she's distinguishing womanist theology, black women's theology, from black theology, and saying great insights don't include women social analysis, and then also distinguishing womanist theology from feminist theology. And she writes here, feminist theology and black women. Feminist theology emerged as a part of the women's liberation movements in America. This theology's biases, especially as they affect its import for black women, mirrors the biases of these movements. Bell Hooks aptly characterized the American women's movement when she pronounced, "Every woman's movement in America, from its earliest origin to the present day, has been built on a racist foundation." Essentially, the first distinctive women's movement in America evolved out of abolitionism. And this became the 19th century movement. So out of abolitionism and black and some white people's struggle for freedom against slavery, you get women emerging and fighting for the right to vote. The contemporary women's movement likewise emerged out of the 1960s black freedom struggle. So you have the black freedom struggle in the United States, and then at the end of the 1960s, feminist theology, in a sense, being born out of adopting some of their ideas and saying, right, let's apply that to us as well. This movement found women demanding freedom from their exile in the domestic realm and equal access to the male-dominated social political realm. Undergirding both movements was a struggle against patriarchalism. Patriarchalism was based on Victorian ideology, which considered women, that is white women, fragile dolls who had to be placed upon protective pedestals. They were consequently relegated to the home and prevented entrance into the public arena. Neither movement acknowledged that black women's lives were an antithesis to Victorian ideology. Neither movement recognized the difference that race makes in relationship to patriarchalism. And consequently, the racial bias distinguished both movements as they neglected the concerns of black women. So I'm speaking for Mary Daly, who is a powerful revolutionary feminist theologian, has been called on the carpet continuously for being racist because she spoke for all women. Like, we women need to do this. And some black women said, "We are not part of your we, Mary." You know, and for even you to think that we're part of we is patriarchal and condescending. You're not listening to our voices. But she did bust down a lot of doors. So she did a lot of work on her way. So that's acknowledged as well. Mary Daly, that is. Kelly Brown Douglas, let's write her up. How are you doing? Are you exhausted with information? Or are you hanging in there? Yes, please.
If you have never read, like I have never read any of these,
yes.
Which one would you recommend to start out with?
Okay, I actually would read The Black Christ by Kelly Brown Douglas, in the sense that she gives you background on all of these people and moves on. She summarizes them on her way. Yeah.
Anna? If I'm jumping ahead, then please tell me, but it seems like if we're talking about Jesus and who is Jesus, that for Jim Cohn and some of the other black men, what Jesus does is liberate, because
yes.
He's on the side of the oppressed and he liberates.
It's his life that's the focus.
And through his life, and then even death, that there has a liberatory effect of the cross. And so is that... Are we moving now to where the women, how they interpret what Jesus does and what his main role and function is?
Yes. Okay. And I would have to say that what is interesting in looking at most of these, many of these Christologies and images of Jesus is you could say, well, the cross is the central thing. Well, when you read James Cone and Cleage and all these people, really, Jesus's ministry and acts of against oppression, his life, is the focus. There is not so much of a focus Even Kelly Brown Douglas, if we want to, doesn't really, she has an image of Jesus on the cross on the front, but she doesn't really get to the cross. Jesus suffers on behalf of the oppressed, but they don't really interpret the cross necessarily. That's not the focal point. So I think that's always kind of interesting too. When we get to Dolores Williams and this Joanne Marie Terrell, they are talking specifically about the cross, but I think even in looking for contributors to cross examinations, it's like, wow, where is the cross? Like, no one's, you know, not, we aren't talking specifically about the cross and its interpretation here. In many places, though. Other thoughts or questions before we move on here? I'm looking at some of these. Let's get Douglas's, when she, I will write down her Christology and where Christ is seen as somebody to carry with us, even if it's not specifically about the cross. So Kelly Brown Douglas, pick up one other. Oh, she has actually, by the way, at least if you identify as a Lutheran, she has a pretty interesting critique of salvation, justification by faith. She essentially says it was a great theology for the white slave owners. Because they didn't have to actually do anything, she says. You know, she says, with salvation guaranteed through belief, white people could be slaveholders and Christian without guilt or fear about the state of their soul. So she talks about, it's a very, you know, one sentence there. One powerful sentence to us Lutherans that says, interesting slaveholder theology you have. So I was thinking, something to at least note along the way. All right. 115. She essentially talks about, she picks up on Cleage's idea that the black Christ needs to be there. We need images of the black Jesus. And then she talks about that womanist theology advocates black churches display throughout their buildings images of black heroines and heroes, making these images just as prominent as were the images of white Christs. Moreover, time must be spent beyond Black History Month pointing out and teaching how these black people who have struggled for the community's survival and wholeness reflect what it means to be Christ in the world. So she says, she has a section where she says, Jesus is a black woman. Picking up on Cleage's idea. A black woman, that Christ is found in the faces of black women. And she makes the point of saying particularly poor. Poor black women who struggle for wholeness and survival for the whole community, not just for themselves. So yes, like she said here, you can see Christ is black, but Christ is also, she wants to say, Christ is a black woman in there, and to put that in there. And she emphasizes the survival and wholeness, and the survival and wholeness includes looking at all the oppressions, how the black community is oppressed from without, and also how they continue the oppression, or those systems of oppression within the community. And she mentions and talks about or stresses that this theology, like Latin American liberation theologies, this theology is done on the ground. reveal, she uses the term ordinary and puts it in quotes, black women. And over again, so in conversation with that, this theology needs to be developed in the lives of real black women in their community and in their struggles, and needs to be corrected by it. And I've been so interested to see how in reading many of these womanist theologians back to back, their grandmas are just figure so strong as the matriarch of the family who fought to keep everybody alive and bring home whatever paycheck to feed all the mouths, and at the end of the day collapse on the porch and sit for 2 seconds. And that Jesus, at least two of them, they mention how hard their grandmas worked, and then also mention how Jesus, they saw, their grandma mentioned that if it weren't for Jesus struggling alongside them, they could never continue getting up in the morning. So that Jesus does figure prominently as a power to keep going and keep working for survival in the face of incredible odds. So, but it's always grandma. It's always grandma. Probably grandma's home in the evening, you know? I was thinking, I want to follow up on this, you know? This grandma image.
Is there anything spoken along the way about the influences of things like a drug or gang culture
yes.
in these theologies?
Yes, actually, Kelly Brown Douglas says the other thing that was problematic about, one thing I love about her writing is she's isolating herself from everybody, or she critiques everybody, you know, she's just walking down the line and knocking everybody out of the way and saying, well, you know, that's a good idea, but here are some problems here. But mostly here are some problems here. She does say the problem is that with the Black Christ, she says everything black and everything African is not great for black people. So she says, I challenge the Afrocentric movement that wants to reclaim our roots in Africa that were stolen from us to see that not everything from Africa was positive for our well-being and wholeness. And not everything that's associated, she says, you know, rap has been a movement that has expressed some very powerful things in the black community, and it's this art form that we can be proud of, but not everything that's rap is positive for our wholeness or survival, so we shouldn't just blanket adopt and say, this is great, because it's black. She says, no, as we need to look at it and say, actually, this is great about it. These things we will stand up against and say, actually, the violence against women and the homophobia and all kinds and the rape and the gang culture that's being supported by it are not positive for the black community. So she specifically mentions that. And the homophobia conversation, she links also to talking about how it's so important for the church to be able to talk about sex and AIDS and a number of things. So those are different kinds of topics there. But other questions or thoughts? Before we're moving on to other people, yeah.
Are all these authors and activists or voices, what are they trying to say? This is what Christianity is, or mm-hmm. are they trying to say we're trying to change it from the top down or from the bottom up? I guess is the question.
Make a universe.
Because someone could say, well. Go find another religion if you don't.
Oh,
like it,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh. Right. It's, you know, it was this great.
Are they saying this is the way this religion is or was intended?
I would say when you get to James Cone and the idea that God is the God of the oppressed, then you're talking about a universal statement about that if you are part of an oppressive movement, you are contrary to the work of God. That's a universal claim about what all Christianity is about. When you get to, when she's saying Christ is a black woman, well, you could look at it both in a way of claiming that all the faces need to be in there, but particularly, she would argue, black women. But there's also a contextualization of theology that's going on. So of not making these big universal claims for everybody, some universal concepts of Christianity, but then what does that look like in the lives of black women? So of taking it down to a smaller scale, so bottom up, if you want to say that, instead of top down. So a few top down statements, and a few bottom-up statements of saying, from my experience, it looks different. And it's not necessarily a different faith, it's just that these universals look different from my perspective. And this is what salvation would mean from my perspective. It's a great question. And I could say, even as a feminist or a womanist theologian, or a woman, I listened to a sermon once and someone said, I mean, who do you go to when everything's fallen apart, the chips are down, you know, you're in the dumps? And I was like, and mentally, like, rhetorical question, I'm thinking, oh, my girlfriends, you know? And he says, Jesus, you know? I was like, oh, all right, Jesus. My girlfriends. Oh, yeah, Jesus, that's the answer. I should know, that's always the answer. And I was thinking, you know, I thought, oh, that's interesting. I was like, you know, and he might have girlfriends or friends he goes to, too, but I thought, well, that might be, you know, even there you could say, like, from my experience, I would look at that maybe a little differently. Right. And where Jesus is, even. Is Jesus in my office when I'm by myself and meditating? Maybe, yes, I hope, maybe. And then is Jesus with the girls out at happy hour? I hope so. yes.
I don't want to take you off course, but...
Yeah.
In some ways, Christianity was imposed upon people who were brought over as slaves, mm-hmm. and that my understanding is it was readily adopted among in slave culture for their own reasons. Mm-hmm. But is there among Black theologians or womanists a resistance to accepting this imposition,
mm-hmm.
or a rejection of the tradition because it was forced upon?
There's a lot of analysis. There's a lot of analysis of what was oppressive and what was actually covertly liberating that the white slaveholders didn't realize was actually could become a liberating tradition. So there's lots of analysis of that, and there are some people, but not among these theologians, who would probably reject Christianity as just an imperialistic tradition and altogether. We should come back to that on Friday. They wouldn't be theologians because they wouldn't be Christian theologians. So I'll have to think about that. I can't think of any names off the bat.
Merit?
Yeah.
I have one.
All right.
Sylvester Johnson.
Okay.
Who was a student of Jim Cone.
Okay.
And basically parted ways because he came to the conclusion that the religion was too riddled with imperialism and racism to be salvific for
Black
communities of color.
But
it is a question that I think we always have to wrestle with: is the tradition at root so misshapen and have been used so many times to hurt so many, or is there a way of finding correctives and reclaiming it? I mean, Catholic women who are feminists ask that question and make different choices and decisions. And
you know, Mary Daly, who a couple of times says she almost been fired.
She's out? No. Yeah. She actually they closed up her office when she was on sabbatical.
Really?
Yep. It's funny, if you look up her website now, she has a t-shirt where she's wearing a t-shirt that says, "Where's Mary Daly?" She's so funny. She's so funny. I'm like, that's hilarious, because I was like, "Where is Mary Daly?" So she's actually wearing a t-shirt that says, "Where's Mary Daly?" Because she's not in her office, they moved her out.
They retired her.
Before she retired, so.
Well, you couldn't get into a class of hers
without
some act of God.
So, Dolores Williams, let's look at, this is based on the article that some of you may have taken a look at. And we'll put up Williams and Terrell so you can have two womanist theologians who specifically are addressing the cross. And if we have some time too, we'll talk about Alicia Vargas, or else she can be also a part of. I wish I had more Mujerista Lutheran theologians to offer you, but I do not. And so I will be able to, we could talk about her tomorrow too, in concert with white feminists and then Lutheran women grappling with these issues of the cross. Alicia Vargas would be another interesting example there. Dolores Williams, could we go around and just, would people be willing, I know we started over here with reading, would people be willing to just read a couple sentences or a paragraph and We can take a look at this together. If you read the article, it'll be familiar to you. Who would be willing to pick up reading out loud? All right, and then we'll just go across.
She works through African-American women's experience of coerced and voluntary surrogacy in the antebellum and postbellum eras. These forms of surrogacy include physical field labor, mammy, or forced nurturing roles, and sexual surrogacy.
Go ahead, just someone pick up and keep going.
From Black Woman Surrogate to Surrogate Jesus. Here she states that the most damaging aspect of Christian Shi'ite theology has been the glorification of surrogacy. In examining theories of atonement, she states that the ideas about how the cross functions and its atoning role vary through the years depending on the needs of the time. Thus, African American women today can also call on this flexible tradition of interpretation to understand the saving work of God in a way that functions to empower them rather than reinforce rules of surrogacy which have been forced on them.
For African American women, the cross comes to represent the historical evil trying to defeat good. The resurrection of Jesus and the flourishing of God's Spirit in the world as a result of the resurrection represents the life of the ministerial vision gaining victory over the evil attempt to kill it. The redemption of humans can have nothing to do with any kind of surrogate role Jesus was reputed to have played in a bloody act that supposedly gained victory over sin and or evil. Rather, it seems more intelligent to understand that redemption has to do with God, through Jesus, giving humankind new vision to see resources for positive, abundant relational life, a vision humankind did not have before. The kingdom of God points to life here, not only afterlife.
That second bullet point goes back to your question on universal, in the sense where she says Christianity, she makes the argument in her article that Christianity is not one universal kind of claim, but it has adapted over time. So this is how her argument builds. She looks over the people we talked about yesterday, Origen, Anselm, Abelard, moving on to the Reformers and things like this, and she says in each century and each time, people interpreted the cross in ways that made sense to their time, through legal metaphors, through feudal metaphors, through the ransom theory, through all these different things, and they were all contextual interpretations of this event. They became known as kind of the orthodox or the most traditional, the traditional ones, but she says, but the tradition is not one thing, but it moves and changes based on the need and perspective of its time. Therefore, she steps in, the need and perspective of our time and my context, in my context, I can claim this flexible line of tradition and say this is how Black women can interpret this. I'm not out of the tradition, I'm a part of this stream. And here's what I claim about the interpretation of the cross, that it actually is evil. It represents evil. And God can conquer evil is the most important message one should get. But that statement, I wanted to put that quote in there about it can have nothing to do with this surrogacy or a bloody act that supposedly gained victory over evil. That was the statement that got in the newspapers and got to Dolores Williams, kind of famous. So it's they can't have to do with it. Yes.
I was bad and didn't do the required reading.
Yes.
So I'm having trouble understanding that argument.
Her argument?
Well, yeah, I can understand how you might conclude that the cross was evil, yes. But I can't understand how you can consider yourself Christian and believe that. So I will see how she finesses.
She believes in the resurrection, the power of the resurrection as God's life-giving response to historical evil. And so
suffering isn't the redemptive part.
Suffering is not the redemptive part. The cross is not the the locus or the place of redemption. Easter is. And when we make the cross the focus of redemption, that's the place of redemption, then we end up in her argument glorifying suffering and suffering for others in a way that has glorifies a very negative and oppressive kind of suffering that especially, she's saying, Black women have felt. And when she talks about the surrogacy, suffering on behalf of the others, of saying, like, more than anyone, she was saying, historically, Black women were kind of forced to carry it all and suffer for everybody.
The sacrificial lamb.
The sacrificial lamb. They took the place of, when she's saying sexual surrogacy, they took the place of white women serving their husbands sexually. They took the place of white women and Black men, or white men of in caring for their children. They, as Mammy, and they also were the ones who worked the hardest in the fields. And they were one step down. So there was Black men, and then there were the Black women workers. So she's saying, we kind of have borne the weight and then been told it's good. And so she's saying, it's not good. Yeah. Right.
One follow-up question.
Yeah.
What does that do to the resurrection, to deny the value of the cross as a step in the way, or does mm-hmm. she not deny that it's a right. step in the way?
Was it necessary in a way? Are we going
perhaps.
Back to that kind of question?
Yeah,
would you
perhaps.
Need to get there? Yeah. I think she would just say you wouldn't need to get there. I don't think she's ever claimed anything on that specifically.
So she doesn't say it's overcoming that evil.
I think maybe it is overcoming the evil, but do you need the evil to have the good? That's kind of what I heard you
ask. Was the resurrection necessary?
The resurrection was, life is necessary by whatever means you get to it, I think would be hers.
So no matter how Jesus died, that God raised him from the dead is the important thing.
Yes, and his ministry before and the response to death are what we need to focus on. And the ministry before, where he's helping the oppressed survive and advocating for their survival and wholeness, and then the response to it, even if he's dead, he's still coming back and advocating for this kind of life and wholeness over death and oppression. It would be her main perspective. So the cross happened, but I don't think she'd ever say it was necessary from the fall or the beginning of time or anything like that. It wouldn't have that theological.
So hers is not an atonement theory.
Right, how does God atone for our sins? Yeah, right. Not necessarily. Her response to the cross wouldn't necessarily be an atonement theory.
So she probably wasn't lining up to see the passion of Christ.
No. I was working on this book when I all these students are going, they all want you to go with them. And it's like, oh, I'm just sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, there are a lot of interpretations of this, you know.
So, Marit, was her understanding of why the cross happened a result of Christ's life and the reaction of the public to his life?
That's a good...
not a God thing, but a people thing, crucifying this whole way of being that's so countercultural, that they couldn't handle it, so they killed.
Yeah, probably for her, because she's focusing on... I will actually, since we've talked about this a little bit, I'll make our little cheat sheet on my own time. We've only got 5 minutes to cover Terrell, so somebody else who responded to William. So I will make that later and kind of go back to, I think, I don't know whether she would talk about the politicalness of it, Jesus's politicalness. It would be more this kind of advocacy for life and wholeness that would be her focus. And maybe our response to that is death. But her, she talks about that surrogate suffering or sacrifice isn't salvific. So that leads us into tomorrow, where other, again, and I will line up the dates, but I'm like, hopefully our feminists who are bringing up the same argument aren't just parasiting off of Dolores Williams, or else her argument about white feminists taking everything from Black women is completely correct. Surrogate suffering or sacrifice isn't salvific. Easter, conquering death and suffering, is salvific. The conquering of it in whatever way that's carried forward. And then she has a concern with the message of the cross for Black women. Let me quickly present Joanne Marie Terrell's ideas, and then I'll create a cheat sheet for her too to bring back in. Dolores Williams, you know, then after Williams says this, people are saying, oh, so Black womanist theologians don't like the cross, you know. But she's not speaking for all black women theologians. She's speaking for herself. And Joanne Marie Terrell is another author, the one who I mentioned. She wrote a book called Power in the Blood, The Cross and the Experience, and the African-American Experience. She has a very different perspective, where she goes through Kelly Brown Douglas's work, this Jacqueline Grant's work, who wrote on how black women, that Christ has been, or that Jesus is very personal and important as an empowering force, where white women have focused on Christ. So she differentiates white women's Christ from the black women's personal Jesus that empowers them throughout the day. It's not just an idea. It's a living force of struggle against oppression. Terrell picks up on these conversations and says, is there something about the cross and bloodshed that's redemptive in some way? And she says yes. She thinks there's power in the blood, contrary to, in a way, what Williams has put up. Terrell says, equates the deaths of, well, she uses an analogy throughout her book, the deaths of Jesus, the death of Emmett Till, who was, in 1955, a young black man who was accused of whistling at a white woman and brutally murdered. And then there were lots of pictures of his body in the casket and his really deformed body after he was lynched and killed that were all over the place. And she said, the death of Emmett Till was not a good thing. It wasn't necessary or planned from the beginning of time, but it galvanized the civil rights movement. That image and that death did something powerful. So it wasn't good, but there's power there. She'd say the same thing about the death of Christ. It wasn't good, but there's power there, transformative power. And then she also even says, and this is what I think is really radical, heading into tomorrow, we might have to just bring her back, is she says her own mother, she said, my mother was murdered at the hands of a jealous lover, shot and killed when she was a young girl. She said, it was a terrible and gruesome and violent death. Does it have any power in it, or is it just evil? And she looks back at the death of Jesus and Emmett Till and her mother's and says, even all these women killed or slaughtered in domestic violence, she said, if we don't look at it or don't remember it, it has no power. We can make it not disappear. But if we refuse to, in a way, leave the grave and tend that garden, she says, tend the garden of that memory so that it transforms or changes things in our lives and in the future, there is power in that blood, and it's good, sustaining, life-giving power. And that's her interpretation of the cross, and it's very different. So she wouldn't say, yeah, God planned Jesus' death, that this blood was, you know, eternally necessary, but it happened, and some of these deaths have unique power to them. It
has a different purpose from atonement.
Yes. Yes, a different purpose for atonement.
From atonement.
From atonement, right. It would be, and I'm going to think more on that. I know you all are leaving today, but I'm going to think more on just this idea of that Jesus' death here is primarily thought about in all of these writers, and I can't think of an exception yet. In terms of how we struggle with injustice and oppression, not
personal.
And in that struggle, we are made right with God. That is the process of reconciliation or joining in with the presence of God in the world. That is where it is. It's not an amelioration of individual sins in some way, in kind of a more abstract way. It's a lived out social changing of sinful pattern. So it's a very different, if it was atonement, it would be a very different interpretation of what atonement means, right? Yeah, one more hand, and then...
But the kicker that just galvanized it for me is that for them, Jesus is a living force,
yeah,
not past event.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All of this talk about atonement talks about a past event and allows us to keep it back there rather than dealing with Jesus as living force now. that may have been through that past event, but is also with us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess to put it in words of, you know, bringing heaven to earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would even be, with Jacqueline Grant, who we won't write up her Christology, when she's talking about white women's Christ, you know, this kind of ideological past event, kind of the universal kind of thing, and black women's Jesus, who's going to help me through the day and get to the end of the day and survive. That kind of living life force, but it's great insights. So I will make up a couple cheat sheets on them and bring them back tomorrow, and we'll move on. If you want to pick up a hand.